Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Merrill Lynch, one of the best-known names on Wall Street, famous for being bullish on America. Today it's in the news for another reason entirely, a big, big miss on subprimes. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management. Committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here. It's Wednesday today, the 24th of October. And there's a word that'll be helpful to understand as we make our way into that Merrill story. It's write down. When a company says a certain line item on its books isn't worth what everybody thought it was, Merrill Lynch wrote down almost $8 billion in loans and other credit-related investments today, and in the process revealed its first quarterly loss in almost 6 years. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports the write-down was almost $3 billion more than the company just predicted.
Not even 3 weeks ago, Merrill Lynch warned investors it might lose up to 50 cents a share in the third quarter. Oops, make that more like $2.82 a share, the brokerage said today. In a conference call this morning, CEO Stanley O'Neill said something you rarely hear from the corner office.
I am accountable for these mistakes just as I am accountable for the performance of the firm overall.
O'Neill explained that after the earlier profit warning, Merrill Lynch took a more conservative look at its subprime mortgage holdings and other credit investments. Staffers decided their calculations had been overly optimistic. The mea culpa impressed analyst Dick Beauvais with Punk Siegel, but he still doesn't buy the numbers. Beauvais says fancy investments like collateralized debt obligations don't trade very often, so it's tough to know what they're worth. Beauvais says what's clear is that they're worth less and less.
People aren't paying the interest on their loans. Therefore, when you spin it up to CDOs and VIEs and SIVs, they're not getting the interest. Those things have to be marked down. We're just in the beginning of this. It's going to continue.
Merrill Lynch was the last of the five big investment banks to report third quarter earnings and the only one to report a net loss. But unlike the other banks, Merrill Lynch's third quarter included September. That means Merrill recorded some losses that other banks haven't. Some analysts expect to see more bad news when fourth quarter earnings season rolls around. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Today, for the first time, we saw a government official put a price tag on the wildfires here in Southern California. $1 billion. And that's just in property damage. It doesn't account for the businesses that have been forced to shut down or for jobs lost. Still, as Marketplace's Bob Moon reports, the odd result in the long run may be an economic shot in the arm.
It seems the insurance industry's early estimate of $500 million in property damage throughout Southern California wasn't even close. San Diego County's Emergency Services Director Ron Lane told reporters that doesn't begin to approach the losses in his area alone.
Based on initial estimates, just the homes damaged will be over $1 billion.
It's disastrous news, but out of the fire comes the Phoenix.
It's tragic for people who have lost their homes, but in the long run, it'll probably be a net positive.
University of San Diego economist Alan Jin. He says it's true business disruptions are costing tens of millions in lost revenue every day, but he says insurance money and other disaster aid should more than make up for the financial losses being suffered now.
Construction employment had dropped considerably in San Diego County. We were down 5,000 construction jobs compared to the same period in 2006. So not all those people will be brought back to work, but as the rebuilding occurs, a lot of people in construction will go back to work.
Real estate executives are also hopeful that rebuilding activity will benefit the slumping housing market. L.A. area economist Jack Kaiser says it might even bring a spike in rental rates or at least fill some homes that have gone vacant recently.
where you had a lot of speculators that bought condos in the high-rises in and around downtown San Diego, they'll probably be happy just to have some revenue coming in.
It could take years for other parts of the local economies to recover, though. The 20,000 avocado trees that burned in the San Diego area, for example, will take some time to replace. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Congressional Budget Office released its latest estimates for the costs of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan today. Best guess is, by the time it's all said and done, the tab could run as high as $2.4 trillion. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Just a few months ago, the Congressional Budget Office estimated the total cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan would be $1.6 trillion. But that old estimate left out one big piece of the puzzle, interest. Steve Koziax, a defense analyst at the nonpartisan Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
I think it's fair to say that we have pretty much financed this war on the national credit card.
Today, the CBO said over the next 10 years, Americans could pay up to $705 billion in interest payments to finance the wars. But White House officials, who initially estimated the war in Iraq would cost $50 to $60 billion, dismissed the report as, quote, a ton of speculation. All sides agree the future costs of the war are difficult to predict. Lawrence Korbes, a defense analyst at the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank.
If anything, it's a little bit conservative.
But Korb and Koziak say one thing is clear. Keeping troops in the region is getting much more expensive as the military struggles to replace worn-out equipment. The surge in Iraq increased troop strength about 10% since 2006, but
the number of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan really hasn't varied all that much since 2003, and yet the amount of funding provided has increased from roughly an average of about $100 billion a year in 2004, 5, and 6 to close to $200 billion.
Which means next year, the United States will spend almost $1 million for each soldier, Marine, or airman deployed in the region. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Put your finger up in the air. Draw the letter U. That's the basic chart of what happened on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Congratulations, everybody. You can now say you were present at the creation of what could prove to be the next wave of internet insanity. Microsoft announced today it beat out Google, and it's going to buy 1.5% of the social networking site Facebook for $240 million. Put your calculators away. I'll tell you right out, the deal values Facebook, which just a couple of years ago was only a gleam in the eye of 24-year-old founder Mark Zuckerberg, at $15 billion. Todd Degress runs the venture fund Spark Capital. Mr. Degress, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
What do you think of this $15 billion number, and where did it come from?
Well, where it came from, I think, is, I think the Facebook guys, I think Zuckerberg's a smart guy, and I think he said, what is the most absolute wild-ass valuation I can think of justifying? And he came up with $15 billion, and I think he got two guys in the room that needed to have the asset that would find that to be a very small percentage of their market caps. I don't think you can justify it based on future cash flows, but I guarantee you there's a model floating around out there someplace that justifies it based on future cash flow.
We see all these reports of all these people registering for Facebook. I, in fact, did it myself last night just to see what it's like. What am I worth in this calculation?
You're worth $300.
$300. How do you get
that
number?
You're worth $300. I mean, if you look at the current people who are on Facebook and you imply value based on a $15 billion valuation, you're worth about $300 to them. Now, you're currently not being monetized to that level, but obviously they feel that they'll be able to monetize you each year. You'll basically send them a virtual check for $300.
But what if I leave tomorrow? I mean, I'm not exactly in the prime Facebook demographic,
Then you're gone. I think that's the big question, is the value is really based on how many people go there and how long they spend based on how much time a month and then how many months they stay on. I mean, that's kind of the value of a subscriber is based on you know, how much time you have to monetize them. They're going to have to do some real gymnastics to get customers to stick around, because I would argue that there isn't necessarily a lot of loyalty on these sites, and there isn't necessarily a lock-in. If something cooler comes along tomorrow, they're gone. I mean, look at MySpace. I mean, MySpace at one moment looked like it was the place to go, and I think it's reasonable to assume that in a year or two from now, there'll be a cooler place to be than Facebook.
You know, the word that comes to mind, of course, when you start seeing a number like $15 billion for a company like Facebook is bubble, dot-com bubble, right? But we've been down this road before. You're not really telling me that we're going to do now the exact same thing that we did less than 10 years ago.
Not exactly the same thing. Last time companies were going public and public shareholders were getting pummeled because they were investing in the bubble. This time, the companies that are acquiring them are public, and they'll suffer if the valuations of those companies turn out to be way too high, but they won't suffer as much, and the individual investor won't suffer as much, because those companies obviously, Google and Microsoft have other businesses besides this.
But in a way, though, it's worse, because Google and Microsoft are supposed to know better than the average guy who just wants to get a share of say, Yahoo in 1999.
Yeah, I think this is a combination of buying an expensive insurance policy and investing in the future for those guys. It's very expensive outsourced R&D, and it's also a realization that you can't necessarily build these kinds of properties internally. You need entrepreneurs who have big ideas and who have passionate teams. It's a realization that those kinds of things don't come from big companies.
What do you think might happen to cause this bubble to burst, or to at least calm down in some regard?
There's two factors that could lead to the bubble bursting. One is the broad economy. If the broad economy takes a big hit, then there's going to be a trickle-down effect to companies like Facebook. The second thing that could harm them is if all of a sudden people felt that online advertising wasn't what it's cracked up to be. If people feel like the value of having somebody look at a web page is going to drop a lot, then the valuations on all of these companies will plummet.
Todd Degress is a partner and the co-founder of Spark Capital. We reached him up in San Francisco. Mr. Degress, thanks a lot for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
South African businesses are betting on an economic turnaround in neighboring Zimbabwe. A human rights group in Johannesburg said today South African companies are investing there in the hopes of big profits if stability does somehow return. But that's a pretty big if. In Zimbabwe right now, it's almost impossible to find staples like bread or like rice. Inflation is officially more than 6,000%. That's despite the price controls that President Robert Mugabe imposed last June. To avoid selling at a loss, grocery stores have just stopped stocking their shelves, which is forcing people to travel hundreds of miles and to cross the border to buy their groceries. Gretchen Wilson reports from Messina, South Africa.
It's the dead of night at an outdoor bus station in this South African border town. 100 people, mostly women from Zimbabwe, lie on plastic bags and cardboard. Rats run back and forth inches from Justina Vidzai's head.
You have to sacrifice.
Zimbabweans need the basics. Things like oil, salt, rice, and bread. Vidzai caught a bus from central Zimbabwe yesterday at 8 a.m. So many people packed the border crossing into South Africa that she had to spend the night there in a rainstorm. Then she made her way to this border town bus station, where she's spending one more night before shopping.
I come here every month, so I buy a grocery for the whole month for 30 days. Then I'll come back again.
She has to stay in South Africa 24 hours, or in Zimbabwe, they'll slap her with an import duty. All told, it's a five-day journey. Incredible as it sounds, Vidzai is well off by Zimbabwe standards. She has a job and can use her payslip to cross the border. The jobless have to cough up $300 for a South African visa, something most can't afford. So anybody who makes it here buys extras to sell on the black market back home. Miadzai Danda says she'll make 100% profit on soap.
It's little, so that I can get money to send my child to school.
Storefronts here in Messina cater to Zimbabwe's desperate buyers. Chalkboards outside the Sunrise Discount World post the latest prices for vegetable oil and laundry soap. Down the road, the Super Spar grocery store heaves with Zimbabwean shoppers. The store sets out extra cartons of laundry detergent. Carts overflow. Store manager Peter Cookmore says sales have jumped 50% since Mugabe froze food prices in Zimbabwe. He's swamped with emails from Zimbabwean store owners begging to buy anything they can at a closeout price.
And they're looking at baked beans, peas, sweet corn, corn flakes, bran flakes. It's all necessity goods just to live from.
South African wholesalers used to stock Zimbabwe's retailers, but not anymore. Jason Rana is chairman of the Messina Local Chamber of Commerce and used to sell to Zimbabwean middlemen.
Since the price control came into effect, they are not coming anymore because they have to go and sell it at a cheaper price than what they paid. And they would definitely lose that money.
Now he's losing money too.
We are also suffering at the same time. You know, we used to have 42 people working for us. And now we have 27.
Rana says Mugabe's price caps have destroyed formal trade and fueled unaffordable prices on the Zimbabwean black market.
I think the worst is now here. And if nothing is going to be done about it, there's a lot of people going to die, and people are dying daily.
Back at the bus station, Shimbarashe Munamo has done his shopping and is ready to go home. He's a high school teacher who comes to South Africa once a month with homemade brooms to sell. He buys goods and brings a few bars of soap back to his principal, who wouldn't let him go on these 10-day trips otherwise.
Because even himself, he cannot afford to get soap.
Munamo packs up what he's bought on this trip. Non-dairy creamer he dilutes to make milk, macaroni, a pair of tennis shoes.
Most of the things that I have bought is for my family.
He has to pack efficiently. South Africa's informal bus drivers set up roadblocks to control this road, and they charge everyone $3 a bag. It's literally highway robbery. But it's just another sacrifice thousands make every day to bring home food. At the border between South Africa and Zimbabwe, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, turning up some dirt on the farm bill.
The question Congress never seems to answer is why, as in why should the federal government be in the business of subsidizing agriculture at all?
But first, let's do the numbers. Grim housing numbers pulled stocks down today, only until investors pulled them right back up on hopes of another interest rate cut next week. Don't know where that one's going to come from. The Dow Industrials closed flat, down slightly less than a point at 13,675. The Nasdaq parted with 24 points, 0.8%, closed at 2774. The S&P 500 shaved off 3 points, 0.25%, to finish at 1515. That ginormous write down over at Merrill Lynch that Amy Scott was telling us about cost the financial services behemoth 5.8% today. And you know, meeting expectations these days just ain't gonna cut it. Amazon.com kissed 12% goodbye today. That's after quadrupling earnings in the third quarter. It just didn't beat expectations. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to an energy-independent America by increased use of public transportation at publictransportation.org. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, also sponsoring PBS's CEO Exchange, shrm.org. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
Thank you. from the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on durable goods orders and new home sales for September. A Senate committee holds a hearing on sweatshop conditions in Chinese toy factories. And President Bush takes a trip out west to look over the scorched landscape of Southern California. Over 500,000 people have been forced out of their homes, the biggest evacuation the state has ever seen. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Almost $300 billion worth of crop subsidies and big-ticket government nutrition programs landed right in the lap of the Senate Agriculture Committee today. It's officially called the Food and Energy Security Act. You can just call it the Farm Bill, if you like. It covers everything from school lunches and food stamps to weather-related disaster aid for farmers. It comes up for renewal every 5 years, and every time the result is a legislative battle over the government's proper role in keeping food on American tables. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale tells us this year is no different.
Healthy prices for most crops are generating strong profits for farmers right now, and those who'd like to wean growers from government support payments think the time is ripe for reform. But when he unveiled the Senate bill to the Agriculture Committee today, the chairman, Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin, didn't list subsidy reform as an achievement.
It's a forward-looking bill that makes critical investments in energy, conservation, nutrition, rural development, and I might add, promoting better diets and health for all Americans.
Advocates of reducing subsidies, including a former Agriculture Committee chairman, Republican Richard Lugar of Indiana, expressed disappointment in today's Senate bill.
U.S. farm programs have cost taxpayers too much and hurt American agriculture in the process. Subsidy programs have spurred farm consolidation, violated international trade agreements, and still left most farmers heavily exposed to risk.
Lugar will offer an amendment to replace subsidies with a broader crop insurance program that will pay all farmers, not just those in the current program, when they lose money. Another reform to be offered by North Dakota Democrat Byron Dorgan would cap subsidy payments at $250,000 per farm per year.
This farm bill has become much more than a safety net for family farmers. It's become a set of golden arches for some of the biggest corporate agri-factories in the country, and I think it has to stop.
Unlike the House-passed bill, which limits subsidies to farmers earning less than $1 million a year, the Senate keeps the current income cap of $2.5 million. The Senate bill does ban payments to people who can't prove they get most of their income from farming. Critics want stronger limits on subsidies for wealthy farmers. They also say subsidies have for too long been concentrated on a few basic commodities, such as corn, wheat, cotton, and soybeans. The Senate Farm Bill includes $2 billion for growers of fruits and vegetables, assistance long advocated by Michigan Democrat Debbie Stabenow.
We know that part of where we need to go in the future around nutrition is to make sure we can grow those fruits and vegetables in the United States. Right now, we don't grow enough to meet our nutritional standards.
Environmentalists are also taking aim at farm subsidies.
The Farm Bill is the most important piece of conservation legislation that we'll pass this decade.
Robert Bonney with Environmental Defense is urging Congress to reduce subsidies and spend the savings on protecting rural land.
Crop subsidies often provide an incentive for landowners to take marginal grasslands or flood-prone lands and actually put them into crop production. And those things obviously rob us of important wildlife habitat or water quality areas, so subsidies can have a negative impact on the environment.
Subsidy defenders say they are a vital safety net for farmers who must endure dramatic swings in commodity prices from droughts, floods, and infestations. The American Farm Bureau's Bob Young has been lobbying for farm subsidies for over 25 years. He says they get more difficult to defend as Americans leave their rural roots behind.
And the further I think we get away from, you know, just the reality of what it takes to make crop production, to make livestock production happen, the tougher it is that, you know, you tend to get suggestions and policy proposals from folks that have not a clue as to what it takes to make this stuff happen.
Senate leaders are hoping to pass a farm bill this month with an eye toward reconciling with the House-passed version and having a bill on the president's desk by the end of the year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here's something to think about as the Senate gets ready to vote on that farm bill. North Dakota has one senator for every 318,000 of its residents. California, on the other hand, has a senator for every 18 million of us. Commentator Jonathan Chait says that funny math is just one of the reasons farm policy doesn't really ever change.
Right now, Congress is debating the farm bill with the usual questions of who will get the money, what they will have to grow or not grow, and just how much they'll rake in. The question Congress never seems to answer is why, as in why should the federal government be in the business of subsidizing agriculture at all? Economists and policy wonks of all stripes generally agree that farm subsidies are terrible. They drive up the price of food for poor Americans, keep poor third world citizens in poverty by driving them out of international markets, and waste billions of dollars in taxpayer money. Yet farm subsidies have been going for three quarters of a century now, with no end in sight. Why do they survive? One obvious reason is the design of Congress. Unlike industries concentrated in one or two cities, farmers are spread out in every state. The small population states, which are proportionately overrepresented in the Senate, tend to have lots of agriculture. The other reason is that people think of farming as a noble calling, rather than a business, which is what it is. This summer, well-meaning rock stars once again banded together to hold Farm Aid. You never hear of concerts to benefit struggling restaurateurs or convenience store owners. Farmers supposedly deserve unique sympathy because they work long hours, or outdoors, or with their hands. Yet this is true of lots of occupations. Prostitution comes to mind, but there are other legal ones too. Or we should subsidize farmers because we need food. Well, sure, but we need houses and clothing too. That we need those things is a sign that there's a demand for them, which is exactly why the free market can handle it. The strangest thing about the debate over the farm bill is the assumption that there needs to be a farm bill in the first place.
Jonathan Chait is the author of The Big Con, the true story of how Washington got hoodwinked and hijacked by crackpot economics. He's also a senior editor at The New Republic. We'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America. By the Medtronic Foundation, sponsoring The Mysterious Human Heart, a PBS series exploring diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of heart disease through science and technology, premiering on PBS in October. And by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, the World Series starts tonight, as you have surely heard. But a furniture company in Boston started thinking about this week back at the beginning of the season. Jordan's Furniture, owned by Warren Buffett, as it happens, ran a big promo back in March and April. Buyers would get back the full purchase price for their couches or whatever they buy if the Sox were to win the World Series. We gave CEO Elliot Tittleman a call earlier today to ask him if he was worried about possibly having to pay back all those millions of dollars.
Oh, no. Are you kidding? This was the greatest thing we ever did. We sold a ton of furniture. We've got a ton of people rooting for the Red Sox, and here we are in the World Series. It couldn't get any better.
Especially because he's also got an insurance policy to help him pay out, if need be. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow closed flat even after a rocky, rocky day. The Nasdaq dropped 24 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, 0.25% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, there's a dance you do with fundraising.
To find the intersection between the interests and background of a donor and the needs of an institution. If you find that intersection, that's the sweet spot.
It's a conversation from a nonprofit corner office tomorrow. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.